If you're sitting there and thinking to yourself something like, okay, I heard that parable, but I don't get it. Trust me, you are not alone. I've read it many times, but I don't think I've ever preached on this text before because, well, it's hard to make sense of. I mean, on the surface, the story is simple, if not unusual. A master, a wealthy business person, called in the man who managed his vast holdings and operations. And the businessman said to his manager, I'm hearing surprising, disturbing things about you, that you're squandering my money. I simply can't have that. I'm going to audit my accounts, so get ready. I'm going to have to let you go. You know, sometimes you see it coming. You know that your position is going to be downsized or relocated or outsourced. Other times it just comes out of the blue. And for a while you don't even know what hit you. And as he left his master's office, the manager's mind must have been racing. This has been the best job I could have imagined. What can I do? I don't have the muscles or the calluses to work in the fields. And there's no way I can be seen in town begging. Then an idea came to the manager. He had just left the master's office, so there's no way that anyone could have heard yet that he was about to be let go. So he quickly sent messages to all the people who owed rent or crops, or other debts to the master, sent messages asking them all to come quickly. You owe my master 100 barrels of olive oil, he said to one fellow. Here, give me your statement. And with the stroke of his quill, he crossed out 100, wrote 50, and initialed it. The next fellow pulled out his statement. The manager took his pen, X'd out 1,000 bushels of wheat, jotted down 800 bushels, added his signature. Those are the two examples Jesus included in the parable. We presume that the soon-to-be unemployed manager did something like that with all the people who owed payments of crops or rent to the master. Now, the parable does not end with the master getting wind of this scheme and having the manager arrested. It doesn't end with the manager taking off for Tahiti, never to be heard from again. Jesus ended the parable noting that the master actually praised the manager for doing such a shrewd thing. It doesn't make sense. One way I can try to get into a passage like this is to ask myself, why did Jesus tell this story now? But he was trying to make a point. Why did he think of all things, a businessman commending his manager for being shrewd, clever, maybe even dishonest? I mean, other parables that Jesus told are fantastic. Good Samaritan, that's a killer. The shepherd leaving the 99 sheep so that he can find and rescue the one lost sheep, love that one. The prodigal son and his older jealous brother. Oh my gosh, the points of those parables, they're clear, they're powerful. But as he told this story about the shrewd manager being praised for unilaterally reducing the debts owed to his master, I'm trying to imagine, what was Jesus thinking? And when I think about that, the answer is clear. I don't know. I don't know why Jesus chose to tell this story. I mean, let's say it. Compared to the other parables that Jesus told, this is not one of his best. So I started working on this sermon Wednesday afternoon. That evening, I had a ministerial conference with a pastor friend of mine from the East Side. Okay, you may have seen her on Facebook. We went to the Indians game. So he's one of the ministers at Forest Hill Church, a Presbyterian church in Cleveland Heights. Eating our nachos, as we were watching the game, I mentioned that I had decided to tackle this particular gospel passage. And so we started talking about it, right as the game was going on. We multitasked. We talked as we watched Frankie Lindor ground out to the second baseman. Oscar Mercado hit a tapper back to the mound, thrown out at first. Carlos Santana hit a dribbler down the third baseline that almost made it to the base, but because the Tigers were in the shift, there was nobody there to cover it. Infield single. And then Yasiel Puig singled to the right side, moving Santana to second base. And then Mike Freeman struck out, inning over. Anyway, while all that was happening, we talked about this parable in Luke about the shrewd manager. My friend said, John, I've looked at that story for 30 years. I still don't know what it means. Now, that made me feel better because I think he's one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. But I only felt a little bit better because I still had to preach on it this Sunday. But my friend continued, John, say that you write 40 or 50 sermons a year. One of them is bound to be a clunker. He said, I think this parable of the shrewd manager is Jesus's clunker. He tried, but this parable just doesn't measure up to the others. And I said to him, about the only thing that I can make sense of in this parable is that the manager was willing to take some risks in order to prepare for a very different future coming his way. Now, there are details about the arrangements he made that would be helpful for us to know, but Jesus didn't go into that detail. So I told him, the point to me is that the shrewd manager took the initiative to act in order to adapt to how his world was going to be changing. My friend responded, it makes me think of that place in Matthew's Gospel where Jesus is sending out his disciples on their first mission trip. He knows it's not going to be a walk in the park for them. They're going to face disinterest or skepticism from the people. They're going to face outright opposition from the religious establishment. They're going to need to be wise to the ways of the world. So Jesus cautions him. He says something like, listen, I'm sending you out just like a sheep to a pack of wolves, so you must be as cautious as snakes and as gentle as doves. Okay, I responded to him. So the shrewd manager was wise to the ways of the world, cultivating friendships that would be very helpful to him in the future. Bible scholars have analyzed and dissected this story in great detail. They propose three different understandings of just what that manager, that steward, if you will, they propose three different possibilities of what he was doing when he reduced the amount of all those debts. First possibility, the manager, the steward, was cheating the master by reducing the size of the debts. Yeah. Or the steward was actually acting righteously by doing away with the interest that the master had figured into the debt because that interest was forbidden by Deuteronomy chapter 23. So the manager was doing a righteous thing. Or, third possibility, the steward reduced the debt by the amount of his own commission on those debts, which had been included in the debts. The first two options, they cost the master. The third option costs the manager, the steward. But the manager would gain something of lasting, immeasurable value, something that we rarely think about when we hear this parable with 21st century ears. That steward, that manager, would gain favor from all the people whose debts he reduced. And in that culture, that time and place, they would be indebted to show him endless hospitality. That's the way it worked back then. That manager wouldn't have to worry about where he'd live or what he'd eat once he was evicted from the master's compound, because those whose debts had been reduced would welcome that manager into their homes and families. Understanding the cultural importance of honoring obligations of hospitality, the master's praise would be for the manager's cleverness at making arrangements so that others would happily take care of him in the future. Oh, there's another explanation also for the master's praise. In that ancient culture, a person's and family's reputation or honor was of immeasurable importance. The master's reputation would be enhanced considerably by what appeared to be his gracious decision to reduce all those debts owed to him. Today it would be like getting a huge boost of positive publicity. And despite the monetary cost to the master of all those reduced debts, in that culture, there was simply no way that that master could ever reverse that action to get that money back. If he reversed that action, that would cause enormous permanent damage to his honor, to his reputation. So reversing the manager's debt reductions, that simply was not an option. And so the master commends the practicality of that steward. He commends the practicality of that shrewd or crooked or dishonest or clever manager who acted decisively to provide for his future. He did what he was able to do in order to adjust to the new reality that was coming his way. And maybe that's a thought that a staid, established institution like the Presbyterian Church USA, or a comfortable, content congregation like this one, maybe that's a lesson we might take away from this difficult parable. Are there ways that we need to act decisively to provide for the witness of the PCUSA in the world? Are there ways that we need to act decisively so that Rocky River Presbyterian Church continues to grow in our ability to share with our community the gospel of God's saving love in Jesus Christ? Tradition. It's part of the fabric of the Christian faith. Tradition results in familiarity. And familiarity is always more comfortable than newness and change. And yet the world we live in never stops changing. As an institution, and as a local faith community, we will grow increasingly irrelevant if we're not open to adapting to changing circumstances in our world. Let me share 4 examples. For instance, I know that the Presbyterian way of doing things expects people who serve as elected leaders, as elders or as deacons, expects them to commit to terms that are 3 years long. That's what our Book of Order states. But what can we do to accommodate people who are only able to commit to 2 years? Or maybe even commit to just 1 year? There are some possibilities. And as a local congregation, we have the ability to act decisively to provide for the future of church governance. Or second, how will we educate people in the Christian faith? The model of Sunday school classes happening at the same time as a worship service, that's been the predominant model of Christian education in this country only since about the 1950s. Christian educators all over are seeing that new models are needed for faith development. Already there are churches trying models that don't depend on a school format restricted to Sunday morning at the worship hour. So how might we act decisively to provide for the future of religious education? Or we take in information visually more than we have ever done before. And yet the church has depended so much upon the spoken word, the written word, in worship, in print communications, even in electronic communications, we are so word dependent. How will we adjust in order to be more engaging visually without abandoning public speaking or print communications? How will we act decisively to provide information in the future? The fourth example you've all experienced already this morning. Offering plates with cash and checks were once the primary means for people to invest in the ministry and mission of their church week by week by week. Today, fewer and fewer people are carrying cash. Those who write checks rarely do it on a weekly basis. And more people are transmitting money electronically when they want to make it happen. Are we going to allow it to become ever more difficult for people to support their church financially? Or are we going to act decisively to provide for a variety of giving modalities in the future? Those are just four examples of how the Christian church might adapt to changing circumstances that we find ourselves in. And how about us individually? How might we be challenged to adapt to changing circumstances in our world? Well, here's a very Presbyterian challenge. Remembering the sovereignty of God. That's one of the essential tenets of the Reformed faith, that God has the absolute right and ability to shape our attitudes and to guide our actions so that we will contribute to fulfilling God's plan for the world. Embracing God's sovereignty. Second possible change, finding the discipline to set aside self-interest sometimes. I mean, our culture promotes individualism. We easily buy into the idea that, yes, I am so important. But there are urgent needs for more compassion, for more respect, for more understanding that would benefit from less me-first attitudes. It would benefit from more focus on finding what is the fairest option for the most. And third, for some of us, adapting to changing circumstances might involve opting to disconnect occasionally from the distraction of electronic devices. Devoting some of that time, perhaps, instead, to striving to enrich relationships with neighbors, friends, children, parents, partners, spouses. And fourth, perhaps a change we can make is remembering the value of community and making gathering with others a priority. Whether that's in the lobby of your condo, or on the sidewalks chatting with neighbors, at the rec center, senior center, in the carpool, at the bus stop, or yes, in worship. For most of us individually, and for all of us as the church, we are not under the pressure that that shrewd manager faced with his impending unemployment and homelessness. We enjoy the benefit of time to discern where and how we need to adapt. What can we do in order to continue to be relevant as a community striving to present God's love in Jesus Christ? In our own lives, we have time to consider how well we're conforming to the model Jesus presented, the model of unconditional love, embracing justice but offering mercy, seeking to serve others rather than looking out only for our own interests. We have time. We shouldn't take forever. For each of us and for all of us, there will be times when we need to act decisively to provide for the future that God intends. Amen.